session number 29566, reel 11.
And Spicer, reel 11. This period of instruction then, am I right in thinking then it gives you a whole basis of how you could operate within the jungle?
Yeah.
Was it useful later on?
Very useful. Very useful. I mean, without that, I think you'd be totally out of your depth, because the jungle, when you first go in, can be a very, very formidable place. Very, very, it's something you've really got to experience to appreciate, because when you first go in, you think, oh, this is not too bad. This is just like an ordinary English forest. But you find you're not in the jungle as such. You're in perhaps what's called secondary jungle. You might have lots of high grass, which are called lalang. You wade through this stuff, but it's not too bad. But as you get deeper and deeper in, you find the daylight disappears. In fact, you don't even know it's daylight, because the vegetation is so thick that it's practically, it's almost dark in there. And when you come into a situation where you have to cut your way through, and this is where your machete comes in, it's just continuous cutting away to force a path through. And you're being hit all the time by flailing branches. There's all manner of bloody creepy crawlies flying about all over the place, although you're not necessarily aware of them. It's dank, it's dark, there's a rotten smell. It's unbelievable. And the sound of the jungle, It varies between total silence to a whole cacophony of bird song noises. Could be lions, could be tigers, depending on whether there's any in that area. I mean, I guess there's even elephants in some parts of it. You don't necessarily see them. But all the time there's this whole noise going on. All the time. And you just can't see a bloody hand in front of you a lot of the time. Then you might come into a clearing and suddenly streaks of sunlight come whizzing down from the world above that you don't know they're there. Then you might go through that. You might hit a rubber plantation. And that is just rows and rows and rows of trees planted probably 8 or 9 feet away from one another in beautiful straight rows, mile after mile after mile, and you'd see the odd rubber tapper, little old lady or a little old man with his little grooved knife going around the trunk with his little tin, and he's got a tin on his back, and he empties the contents of the little tin into his big tin on the back, and then hooks the tin, little tin, the cigarette tin or some sort of little container back onto the tree. And where he's cut the groove out, you see the white sap, the rubber latex, dribbling down the tree trunk. And these go on for miles, absolute miles. And then you might go through a rubber plantation, and you come back into a sort of a jungle area, and you suddenly find that your feet are going from under you. And you're in a swamp area. And you can sink, you can go through swamp up to your waist, up to your chest. Stinking swamp. You come out of there, it's just brown, slimy, green mud. And obviously you've got your weapon either up here, up to face height, or just under your chin, or even above your head. But you're just constantly, all the time, being bombarded with bloody mosquitoes and all sorts of insects. Above this noise all the time, it just you never get really used to it. Well, I mean, You do, I suppose, but you just don't realise that you are getting used to it. But you, every time you go in, it's the same. And when night comes, of course, you still get the odd noise, but the night time is even worse for mosquitoes, because they are just non-stop. There's just barrages of them all the time. That's why, you know, you wear all your sleeves down and overcomes your little camouflage thing over your hat, which you can see through. It's like a netting. But even that doesn't stop it. I mean, they give you mosquito repellent as well to rub on. But in those days, it's not nearly as effective as it is now. The other thing that they give you, there is a parade every day, whether you're in camp or whether you're on patrol. The sergeant or one of the NSOs will give you salt tablets, which are things about as big as the old 10p piece. One of those a day, which you stick in your mouth and swig down with a drop of water as quick as you can, because it's horrible. But it keeps your salt balance up. And the other thing that we used to take was a thing called Mepocrin tablets, which is anti-malaria. I mean, quinine went out, yonks ago, but now they've got all sorts of different things for malaria, but we used to use Mepocrin tablets, one every day. And you're paraded for that, whether you're in camp or out of camp. And you're given those every time.
Was that something that was stressed in your training, that was something that you had to...
Not so much stress, it's just a thing that was sort of brought to the fore. It's not up to you to take it. You're not given a block of tablets to take. It's not your responsibility. It's the NCO's responsibility to call you outside the tent and give them out and make sure you swallow the thing while you take it, while he's dishing them out.
You describe really well the sort of different types of jungle terrain. You know, when you were doing that training period, did they introduce you to different types of areas, or were you really working in the same type
you
of area?
No, you work. They try and give you as many variables as possible. They will take you to a different area each time you go out. You might go to an area that's nothing but rubber. Then you might go, they know a swamp area, or they will take you through a swamp.
So they actually acclimatise you, not only to the climate, but also to the location.
To the terrain, yeah. All the time, you're operating in different areas. So those that are posted to a duty company will know exactly what to expect. There was one instance which I'll just relay to you. It wasn't funny, but to the bloke that it happened to, and it wasn't funny to the bloke that actually did it. But while we were on training, we were taken out one night to do a night ambush. Now, ambushes are laid in a particular way, or they were then. I don't know what they do now. But an ambush is obviously what it says. It is to ambush or catch somebody on the hop when they least expect it. And what they used to do is ambush a track, for instance. If it's well known through intelligence that a bandit group are operating in a particular area and will use a particular track at a certain time, an army patrol or a police patrol or whatever will try and get into that area unnoticed, which then was very, very difficult, because at that particular time there were lots of families, squatters, living in or around the jungle edge. And because they were being intimidated by these bandit groups, used to supply them with information and food. And if they saw any activity by security forces, they would, for their own safety, tell the bandits, or not necessarily the armed bandits. So there were two organisations in the Communist Party set up. There was the actual operational bandit gangs that used to do all the shooting, killing and raping and pillaging and whatever. And the other lot were known as the Minyun, which you did have armed Minyun, but there was a lot of Minyun unarmed. And they were couriers, intelligence gatherers, people that used to keep their eyes open. Hello, there's a three-tonner going up there. It's got British troops on it. It's going up the road there. I'll get in touch with my mate up the road and he'll get word to the local bandit chief or whatever. So you've got to be careful how you go in. Quite often there was decoys went in particularly, and you wouldn't go in there. You'd go in somewhere else. So you've got to use a lot of crafty angles to try and get into an area, to ambush an area without them knowing you're there in the first place. We went to an area just outside a place called Labis, I think it was, one night. And our platoon then was split into two groups. The platoon officer had one group and the platoon sergeant took the other group. And they laid two ambushes along the same track, but not in close proximity to one another. And now, the ambush section, as I say, or the patrol, is usually about no more than 15 or 20 blokes. So if it's split in half, so you've got 8 to 10 guys in each section. And you usually have one Bren gunner in a platoon. So in where you're splitting, you might take two Bren guns before you leave camp, because you need heavy firepower in both sections. So you would have perhaps one Bren gunner in each section, maybe the odd Sten gun here and there. The officer would have his American 9mm carbine. The platoon sergeant might have a 9mm carbine or an ordinary jungle rifle, but the rest of them would have ordinary 303 jungle rifles. Now, you set your ambush in such a way that you have what's called a stop position. That is a group at one end or the other, which allows your victim to walk into an ambush. They don't open fire. So if you've got four guys coming into an ambush position, you obviously don't open fire on the first bloke. You let all four walk in. So you know that they're covered, but you've got to stop at either end. And usually whoever is in charge of that ambush position is in the middle. So he's got a good view. I mean, I know we're talking about vision like that. But if you're ambushing a track, you may be up on a bank. You pick an ambush position which is advantageous to you, not them. So you can see, if you see four blokes, you wait till they get right in the middle before the guy in charge says open fire, and then all bloody hell lets loose. And once the ceasefire is given, you don't all rush out and say, oh, look, we've got this. You stay exactly where you are. And you can stay in position for an hour or more. You might hear moaning and groaning. You don't know what's going on down there. A bloke might be wounded. He might have got a grenade out. He might be, he's flicked the clip and he's waiting for somebody to come up. And usually one person, only one, goes out of ambush positions, and he will go along the track and see if he can identify any casualties. Any wounded, obviously. The first thing that they do is obviously kick or get rid of all the weapons to one side. If there's any wounded, you unlike the Americans, which they would probably shoot them, our guys used to tend their wounded. And that's how an ambush is carried out. But on this particular night, we were split into two sections. And the section I was in, it must have been about 1 o'clock in the next morning. It was still pitch black, and we heard bang! So we thought, hello, the other lot has hit something. But we didn't hear any more. But we came out of ambush position at dusk, only to be told that our Bren gun, or the Bren gunner of that section, had been shot in the foot, in the ankle. And he'd been shot by one of our own blokes, who had been skylarking about in ambush position. He'd flicked off his safety catch, and for some reason, or by accident, I'd put his finger on the trigger and let one rip, and it had gone right through the Bren gunner's ankle. And I'm afraid, I'm not going to mention any names, the Bren gunner, who had been with us all through basic training, he was eventually shipped back to Blighty and discharged. And the guy that shot him went over the wall for 56 days detention. But the hearing of that shot in those surroundings at that time was something else. I've never been so bloody frightened in all my life.
Was it, because it occurred in training, was it quite a useful thing, though, to think about, really, to give you an idea that what
well,
it would be like?
I don't know, because whenever I've been in a situation after that, it's just as bloody frightening. It might have gone some way to what, you know, lead you to what you might expect, but I don't think you ever get over the first time, because I remember later on going out with an army major who took a few guys out with some Malay policemen. And as we approached an area, we were fired on. And everybody hit the ground, and I wish the bloody ground would have opened up. There's no two ways about it. Anybody who says they're not scared under those conditions is either very, very brave, or they're a bloody liar, because when you can't see anybody firing at you, it's quite another thing. I don't know. I've never been in a situation where you can actually see the people that are firing at you. But at least I should imagine, well, I can see him. But when you don't know where it's coming from or when it's coming, you are operating under such conditions where you could be walking within 2 inches of somebody pointing a bloody gun at your head. And I've heard many of our blokes at reunions who've said, I went down in the grass only to realise that there was a bloke staring at me 2 feet away, and he had slit eyes, and he had a rifle pointing in my direction. And I froze, and he froze. It's a situation where you don't know what you do until you are in that situation.
Was it useful, though, in a sense, to give you the idea that this was a serious thing, though, that there should be no messing around on things like this? Because obviously the consequences of somebody messing around had actually got somebody wounded.
Oh, yeah, I think it was. Undoubtedly, you learnt a lesson that you didn't let off your safety catch. I mean, letting off a safety catch is not a necessarily given order by your patrol commander. What you do is, it's a thing where you're patrolling with your safety catch on, but if there's the slightest hint of anything going, it's automatic. Your thumb comes over that. You can't hear a safety catch normally if a weapon is well looked after. I mean, I know there have been cases, I've heard it and read it myself, where, oh, I knew he was there because I heard his safety catch go. But on a well looked after, well oiled weapon, you can't hear a safety catch on a rifle go. It's just a little lever and you can ease it over the other side just like that. You can't hear it. And it's a thing you automatically do. If you think, it's so automatic. You've got your finger there already. You've got your forefinger is under the guard on the trigger, and your thumb is on your safety catch.
So in a situation like that where you were training, though, would he have really been expected to have slipped his safety catch off?
No, I mean, it came out afterwards at the court-martial that he was skylarking about. He was acting the bloody fool. It was a total accident. I mean, it shouldn't have happened. And he got severely punished for it. Because once he did his 56 days, that 56 days is not counted on his service. That's added on. I mean, I never saw him again. I saw him once when we were coming home and he was still there. But, you know, the poor guy that got it in the ankle was shipped home.
Was there anything else from that training period that springs to mind?
Only the fact that how horrendous operating in such conditions could be. I mean, you constantly sweat. You're sweating all the time. It gets cooler at night. In fact, it gets bloody cold at night. But during the day, depending on the terrain that you're going through, progress is extremely slow. I mean, it's obviously quicker going through a rubber plantation. It's not too bad going through secondary. Jungle and swamp area, a mile will take you some time.
What's the terrain like in the real primary jungle? What's it like at the bottom there? Is it a tangled mess or is it quite bare?
No, it's very heavily, it's like leaf mould, but it's very deep. I mean, your boot will sink in, not like it does in a swamp, but you can feel the compression. And as I say, you are continually sweating. It just runs off you in beads. You are saturated. Your uniform is stained. Under the arms, you've got big pools of sweat. Your chest, you can feel it running down the inside of your legs. And all the time, particularly in swamp areas, you can be attacked notoriously by leeches. Now you don't really realise or know that you're being attacked by leeches until you hit base camp. And then the first thing to do is you post guards round your base camp. Certain members are picked out to do a first watch. The sergeant will get all the packs together. You don't cook individually. You cook as a patrol. So usually it's the patrol sergeant or the senior NCO will grab all the packs and he will see what's there. There's a concoction of all sorts of things, or there used to be. I don't know what rations are like these days. There were tins of curry, tins of meat, tins of rice, fruit, tins of mixed fruit. Occasionally we got chocolate. Hardtack biscuits. Corned beef. And he would take perhaps so many tins of bully beef, so many tins of curry, or so many tins of rice. Again, he's got to work it out. And this is where his experience comes in. He's got to work out how many guys he's got to feed for how long his patrol's going to be out for. So if he knows that in advance, he can do it because he's done it before. You couldn't do it, I couldn't do it because we're in training. We don't know We might eat it all today and have nothing tomorrow, but he knows. This is why they give you very experienced NCOs during this period of time. And one guy carries a billy can, and you have what's called a jungle stew. You might get curry, rice, everything, all goes in one pot, bully beef, and you just are dished up. And then he might have a brew up for tea. You're carrying tea. We didn't have tea bags then, it was loose tea. We used to put it in a, we used to have some black polythene bags. And he will divide up the food, and then what he doesn't want goes back in the patch pack, is equally again distributed so everybody's got an equal weight to carry. The poor bloody signal, of course, he's got a wireless pack on his back, and he's got a pack as well. And there's usually at that particular time, a medic who carries a medical pack, but you've also got your own field dressings as well. But I mean, a medic in those circumstances can only give very rudimentary first aid, because I mean, if somebody's shot, you have to call in, if you can get a helicopter, which was very few and far between, you call in a helicopter. If not, you have to take them out to the nearest road, get on the radio and get a truck to come and pick them up. And they're, you know, either take them back to battalion headquarters or invariably the nearest BMH military hospital, which I understand there aren't many these days anyway. But that was the way it was conducted. The food was made up by the NCO in charge, and he would dish it out. And you wouldn't dig latrines. You would do your business wherever, but make sure it's covered up after. Oh, the other essential that everybody brings with them is a loo roll.
Would that be buried as well?
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
You were about to mention leeches, though, when you got into camp. Was there a procedure for dealing with them when you got into camp?
Yeah. When you got to camp, you, as I say, you wouldn't necessarily know you had leeches until you stripped off. The idea was the guards were set, the sergeant did the food, the rest of you made your bivouac up, which was a ground sheet virtually, and you strung a bit of string or your toggle rope between branches. There was usually two blokes to a bivvy. One bivvy went, when I say a bivvy, not the bivouac as we know it today, it's a ground sheet was strung over the top, and the other ground sheet was on the floor. There was no mattresses, there was no, you slept on the jungle floor with the ground sheet between you and the jungle floor, and that was all. Some cases very, very hard, some cases not bad. If you're on a spongy area, it's not too bad. And your small pack was your pillow. But you would strip off, and then you would find these rather large black things, could be as long as your middle finger, clinging to you, all over your body. You might have the odd one or two, you might have a dozen. I've even known blokes to have them inside, just in the top of the penis. Now, the way we were taught to get rid of a leech was don't pull it off. Because as soon as you start pulling, you pull away from the claws that they've got underneath. The best way of removing a leech, and this is where why most of the blokes smoked, was you light a cigarette, and you hold the cigarette to the tip, the other end of the leech that's hanging off, and they just drop off, leaving a little wound with a dribble of blood. And you used to get a handkerchief or a bit of tissue paper or toilet roll and just sponge it out with if the medic had a bit of iodine or gentian violet, you used to just dab it on. And that kit that might have been wading through swamps, you might rinse it out in the river, hang it over your a branch or something, change into your spare kit that you've got in your pack, and that lasts you through the night. And then by the morning, I know this sounds unbelievable, but by the morning, the stuff that you've hung over the branch is dry. So that goes back in your pack. You patrol the next day in what you're wearing, and you do the same procedure. It's turn and turn about all the time.